Battleground State Report with Steve Gill, Michael Patrick Leahy, and Doug Kellett.
And welcome in. This is the Battleground State Report. Go to battlegroundstatenews.com. That's battlegroundstatenews.com. Battleground State News on Facebook. You'll find links to some of the stories that we're talking about today. And I got to tell you guys, I'm watching the two nights of Democrat Party debates between the 10 presidential candidates one night and then another 10 the next. I was kind of flipping back and forth to Shark Week, and I thought I was watching Shark Week as Tulsi Gabbard took a big old bite out of Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
And then came back for another nibble or two as the two engaged, and Tulsi Gabbard getting a big bump. She and Marianne Williamson, I think, were the big winners this week in the Democratic Party debates, the two nights, 10 candidates each, and we'll see in the polling that comes out this coming week what we're going to see in terms of what moved the dial. But we're going to talk a lot today about what transpired in that debate, the Trump having a big rally in Cincinnati at the end of the week, the continued fight over whether Baltimore is awesome or rat-infested. I mean, there's so much that went on this week. So let's just get right into the debate, two nights of debate. A couple of things happening. Candidates in the kind of lower tier, you know, some of them in the zero polling, trying to survive enough. We've used the example. It's like John Travolta, you know, staying alive. They want to stay alive, get enough poll backing, enough fundraising to make the next round of debates in September. And I don't know that some of the lesser knowns were successful in doing that. But Marianne Williamson, the spiritualist who wants us to deal with the American healthcare crisis by giving people rocks, the healing crystals, and then Tulsi Gabbard, I think are the two that may have moved themselves in the debates this week just enough to make those September debate credentials. And if they do, they're staying alive.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And but, Doug, I watched that debate, and what struck me is, do any of these 20 people have a chance on stage against President Trump? What do you think, Doug?
Well, that's always a question, right? I mean, first of all, I think the Democrats need to cut these down and narrow down the candidates, because it's not good for the health of America to have to watch this for two nights in a row, I think.
I was willing to buy into the crystal thing. Hand me a rock because I want to throw something.
Well, Marianne Williamson told an 11-year-old kid this week that, you know, my cat died. And, you know, I'm really sorry about the cat and everything, but how does that really, you know, move the country forward, right? There's a story that came out on Friday that we may need to take Marianne Williamson more seriously than we have before, because she's really catching on. I even heard some former Republicans, I guess they're Republicans, but they, you know, they say that, well, you know, she was really getting to me. She was really resonating with me.
I think, though, Doug, that underlines the nonsense that's being spewed out of the rest of the pack when Marianne Williamson seems to be speaking sense.
Yeah, that may be a real problem for the Democrats, right? I mean, the thing is, Joe Biden, that's really the issue. Is Joe Biden acting like a guy who's in the lead? Is he acting like, you know, a guy could be commander-in-chief? Is he acting like or appears to be someone that can really stand up to Donald Trump in a debate? I think that's the real question, and really through two debates, he really hasn't shown that.
Although he did better in this debate setting than he did in the first round. Now, granted, you know, he didn't lay in a corner and just drool on himself, which is pretty much what he did in the first debate. He still had some fumbles. He still had some bumbles in this one, but he was being attacked by everybody on the stage. It was 9-on-1, and I think from that standpoint, he handled himself pretty well when you're in the target sights of everybody. Mm-hmm. Again, he made some mistakes. I still don't know what the 303-30 thing
at the end
is,
yeah.
But he didn't. You know, he didn't fall apart. He was, you know, mostly conscious and reasonably coherent, which for Joe was a successful night.
Yeah. Well, that's true. I mean, I certainly agree with that. I think the other thing that did shock me, though, was how Obama took such a hit in a Democrat debate the other night. I mean, it's, you know, I thought he was the darling of the Democrat Party, but now Joe Biden being connected with Obama is a bad thing, apparently.
They were attacking the Obama legacy. On the night that Biden was there, 9 of those 10 candidates were attacking vigorously the Obama legacy. I thought he was – didn't they all love him?
Yeah, and I think, again, it was a good night for Joe Biden because he didn't sniff anybody's hair or grope them on the stage. So, again, it was a big win night for Joe.
He did call Kamala Harris kid.
which again is just the silliness of this whole process that,
hey, kid,
you know, kind of kidding, saying, hey, take it easy on me, kid, becomes a news story, a news item. I mean,
well,
you gotta
admit, it was one. Well, look, the debates were so boring, especially that night. That was a highlight, I thought. At least Michael and I were talking about it the other day that, you know, that seemed to be the highlight of the whole evening.
To me, the big point, and as we've all talked before, I mean, we're sports fans. Michael likes baseball for ungodly reasons. I have no clue why.
Steve Gill.
Steve, it was the only sport where my height was not a disadvantage.
Well, Doug and I like football, basketball, you know, real sports, which we're getting ready to crank up as we get into football season. But to me, the highlight of the night is what you have to learn in sports. You want to study the game films of your opponents. And I hope the Trumpers have been watching the game film of that debate, because what I saw was that Kamala Harris has very thin skin. You can get under it. She will get angry quickly when she gets challenged. So in future debates, not only Trump but other Democrats should be watching what happened when Tulsi Gabbard challenged her. It made her mad, and instead of keeping her target sights on Joe Biden, she kept wanting to turn back and punch at Tulsi Gabbard, which only elevated Tulsi. That was a highlight in terms of exposing who Kamala Harris is, and again, it helped elevate Tulsi Gabbard, but more importantly, it exposed the thin skin, the thin veneer that covers up this angry woman that is Kamala Harris.
Angry is the operative word there.
And I just wish Tulsi Gabbard had said, look, you know, while you were servicing Willie Brown, I was serving my country, ladies. They just need to be tougher. Talk more about the moments that were highlights and lowlights in the Democratic Party debates. Did it move the dial? Did anybody advance themselves, fall back? Joe Biden's still in the lead. Is it enough of a lead to make him the putative pick? We'll talk more about it in a moment. This is the Battleground State News, Battleground State Report. Go to battlegroundstatenews.com, Battleground State News on Facebook, and we'll be right back.
This is the Battleground State Report.
And welcome back in. Steve Gill, Michael Patrick Leahy, Doug Kellett with you today, taking you through the news and information on the week that may dictate who controls the Congress, who controls the Senate, and who wins the White House in 2020. We were talking just before the break about the Kamala Harris-Tulsi Gabbard exchange. Another example, Doug, of how it exposed Kamala Harris's thin skin is that after the debate, they went right after Tulsi Gabbard with this bizarre claim that somehow her elevation, her doing well in the post-debate polls is because the Russians are pushing her. She's part of the Russian propaganda push. I mean, it's bizarre, but that shows you how desperate and off their game they are when they're actually attacking Tulsi Gabbard for being some sort of a Russian operative.
Well, yeah, they were saying she was connected or supporting Assad, right, in Syria, and that's sort of her Russian connection, I guess. Well, Cory Booker, in his debate appearance, said that the reason that Donald Trump won the votes in the Midwest was because of, you know, Russian voting suppression. Somehow the Russians kept people from voting. It's one thing to try to influence an election, but it's another thing to keep people from going, and that was Booker's sort of explanation as to how Donald Trump became president. So they were all over the place, no question about it. I think you're right about Kamala Harris seemingly thin-skinned, and that doesn't work well, really, in a debate like this. I think only Donald Trump kind of gets away with that, right? I mean, he sort of works it to his advantage, but that's kind of a fine art.
So the Democrats have three miserable themes. Russia, Russia, Russia. Racism, 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 impeachment, impeachment, impeachment. Not playing very well.
And more importantly, again, with the theme of what we focus upon, how does it play in the battleground states, the Ohio, the Michigan, the Pennsylvanias? To me, where they really lost ground was the fact that They universally, in addition to some of them declaring that we've already lost the war of climate change and we need to head to high ground and the sky is falling. I mean, literally the Chicken Little approach.
But yeah, they Andrew came Yang, out right. He yeah. said it was it's all over. It's too late. Can't do anything about it anyway.
Yep, we head to high ground. You know, our house is on fire. Another one said we can't put out the fire. It's already burning down, and yet they came out against coal. We want to eradicate coal and we want to eradicate fossil fuels. While they were doing this debate in Detroit, once the capital of car manufacturing, in Michigan, where they're trying to rebuild car manufacturing with cars that run on gasoline, I'm not sure how the United Auto Workers, you know, feel about the Democrats wanting to drive the auto industry out of business. I'm not sure how coal miners and those that depend on the coal industry in West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Kentucky feel about the Democratic Party unanimity in wiping out coal. What about people who live in Minnesota and Michigan and these Wisconsin that depend on coal to heat their homes in the winter?
Well, they need to be cold in the winter.
Yeah, just get more jackets.
That's the Democratic policy.
How is that policy agenda? I mean, we've seen how it's played out, Doug, in West Virginia. It turned what used to be a blue state into a red state. Now, apparently, they're going to try to do the same thing with the anti-coal, anti-automotive industry agenda they're going to play in these battleground states.
No, I'm with you. I can't understand. They haven't learned anything since Hillary Clinton ran, right? I mean, Kentucky's become a total red state. The coal miners have become Republican because they're forced to. Same thing in West Virginia. You mentioned Pennsylvania is probably why Donald Trump won Pennsylvania. He said, I love coal. The Democrats mm-hmm. apparently haven't learned from that because Hillary Clinton went to the same places and said, oh, yeah, I'm putting you out of work, but we're going to have some sort of job, you know, recruitment program for you or something, you know, to change your job skills. That just doesn't wear well with people who are, you know, in a career they like.
they're gonna install solar panels in the tractors there.
Yeah, I will tell you, back when in the early 90s when I was working for the U.S. Trade Representative, last part of President Bush, first part of Clinton, NAFTA was the big push. And again, you've got President Trump who struck a new deal with Canada and Mexico, NAFTA 2.0, to improve the trade relations and improve job growth in the U.S., Mexico, and Canada with this NAFTA 2.0. And yet the Democrats are blocking it because they want to keep the economy down so they can hopefully elevate their political prospects. But when we were involved with the NAFTA negotiations and NAFTA decision making, in the early 90s, part of the argument was that okay, yeah, we're going to lose some more manufacturing jobs to Mexico and yet in the South American region, but it's going to increase tourism. And the big pushback from some that kind of were thinking a little bit ahead was, so you're telling me that textile and other manufacturer employees are going to lose their jobs, but they'll be able to get a job at Disney World dressed up as a character? I don't think that's how it's going to play out very well. And you've got the same sort of thing going on now. Yeah, we're going to put all these auto workers, coal miners, everybody else out of work. What are they going to do?
Yeah, I mean, they're talking about changing, what is it, job skills or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That's not real appealing for somebody in their 40s and 50s, is it? I mean, someone who's been working a long time in a certain field, you know, and they think the government is working against them. Isn't that really the bottom line? I've always said, Steve, that I think
they're going to open up some
with
cubicles over at Google, and these people are going to move from an auto worker to working in some cubicle at Google.
All of a sudden, you become a computer whiz, right? But I've said for years, you know, people, they can deal with the government being out of their lives. They can deal with the government, you know, being neutral on things. But they don't like it if the government is opposing them. And when people see that the government is, you know, shutting their jobs down, well, that, you know, changes the equation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, there was a report about some, you know, do-good group that was in West Virginia. A do-good group supported by Hillary Clinton's, you know, policy guys that was going to teach West Virginians how to become programmers. And they had, you know, like
I'm sure they're great, you know, computer programmers in West Virginia, but
this program ended up with, like, you know, nobody getting a job as a computer programmer, and the ones that did get it, you know, was making $15 an hour, was very unhappy.
Well, and again, it's the Democrats are trying to talk down the economy because their only shot at beating Trump is if the economy tails off. So they're blocking NAFTA 2.0.
Right.
They're talking more about, you know, bringing in more illegals and putting more of them on the tax burden to try and hurt the economy.
Sounds like a great plan.
And yet, and I think that the challenge for Trump is when the economy is doing well, people aren't as focused on the economy. If I've got a job, if my wages mm-hmm. have gone up, then it's harder to get me to say thank you and give you my vote than if you're saying I'm going to get you some work if you'll just vote for me. And we just got, you know, on Friday, new job figures came out. The U.S. added another 164,000 jobs in July, despite all the claims that, oh, the trade wars are going to kill jobs.
Yeah, great jobs report.
Unemployment is steady and wages have gone up. Is the Trump team, Doug, doing enough to sell their story? I mean, instead of engaging in some of this bluster about how bad Baltimore is, the president ought to be going, to my view, into places where factories were shut down that are now open, talking to people who had been without a job or were being underpaid, who are now getting more money, keeping more money thanks to the tax cuts. Go to where the success is happening rather than talking about where the Democrats are continuing to destroy places.
Well, you know, I'm going to agree with you on that because, I mean, that was something I was saying earlier this week is that why talk about Baltimore so much? Yeah, Democrats have been destroying big cities, like you point out here, and you can go to these places where, there's an empty factory or something like that and make your point just as you're saying. But I do think he ought to spend more time when he's tweeting on talking about the positive aspects mm-hmm. rather than what appears to be negative sort of comments. But then I'm going to say it again. He's not going to change. This is, you know, the way he operates. Yeah. It worked for him in the past, so he's going to do it again. But it's not the way I would do it, for sure.
Yeah, but he is the president, and he did win. And so this is what you have. I agree that somebody has to figure out how to get into the White House communication team and understand how to help President Trump be more effective with his overall messaging plan. That's a tall order, Steve.
And you're dealing with a president who likes what he likes. I mean, he likes I mean, we saw him in Cincinnati this week with the big rally, people sitting behind him, people cheering. He likes to be fed that enthusiasm.
Sure.
But we've seen that picture a lot.
Yeah.
Let's see a picture of him doing that, but also touring a factory that was shut down
two years ago that
is now open.
So Steve, you get the call. This is the president. I need you to help me. Can you be in Washington tomorrow? Do you go up there?
Yes.
Yeah? And how long do you – what's the over-under on how long you last?
I'm figuring it's a lunch.
I think, he'll hire you in the morning.
I'll be fired by noon.
Fired by noon.
And back home by night.
Well,
I'm sleeping
Steve
in my own
so,
bed again.
Yeah,
is everyone who's ever
plan.
Is listened to Steve for many, many years, they know that Steve is so careful with his opinions about things and would withhold comment even to Donald Trump, right? I mean, so your longevity would be a little longer,
so,
I think, Steve. I think you'd make it at least until the next day.
But maybe 24 hours, maybe 48. But it would be worth it, and it would be a great story, a great book.
I mean, I'd grab as much of the White House, you know, swag as I could, and I'd bring some for you guys.
Thanks.
Golf balls.
Mr. President.
M&Ms.
They're still looking for those towels, I think, from the White House bathroom.
Yeah, I leave the silverware. You know,
Mr. President, Steve is ready for the call.
And we'll work for swag.
And we'll not bring an overnight bag.
I do want to jump up and down on the bed in the Lincoln bedroom.
There you go.
I want to do that. Just, I've always, but with my sock feet, I'll take my shoes off. We're back in a moment with more of the Battleground State Report, battlegroundstatenews.com on the web, Battleground State News on Facebook. We'll be right back with more.
The Battleground State Report with Steve Gill, Michael Patrick Leahy, and Doug Kellen.
And welcome back in. This is the Battleground State Report. You know, in Ohio, unemployment has dropped from 5.2% as Trump took over to 4%. And yet, is the Trump administration telling the good news story about what the economy is doing, thanks to tax cuts, thanks to regulatory reform, thanks to just a confidence level of people believing that you've got folks that want to create opportunity and create business? By the way, when you look at the wages that have gone up, the 99%, we hear so much about the top 1%, the bottom 99% have seen a 10% increase in their wages since Trump took office, while you've seen a 3-4% increase in corporate profits. The bottom line is the growth for the 99%, not the 1%ers, is outpacing the growth of those, quote, big evil corporations that the Democrats were attacking at their debate during the course of the week.
Is there anything that the Democrats like about America?
No, and I think here's a prime example, and we've talked in the past that if President Trump cured cancer, the Democrats would immediately attack him for putting doctors out of work. If he walked on water, they'd scream and do headlines at MSNBC, CNN, and others that he can't swim. We saw that this week. There is a massive wildfire in Siberia in Russia. President Trump calls President Putin and says, hey, look, can we do anything to help? Can we send some, you know, resources to help put this massive wildfire that's building, you know, burning millions of acres? And Putin said, no, you know, we got this, but, you know, we appreciate the help. President Trump was criticized for calling and offering the help. Now, if he had not called, he'd be being attacked for not caring about the environment. It's putting smoke into the air. Yeah. Trump doesn't care about the environment. Instead, he calls Putin and offers help. He's a sellout to the Russians. He's a puppet to Putin. No matter what he does, they're screaming and screeching because they have no policy agenda. All they can do is bitch and gripe.
Doug, what I really liked about the president's tweets about Elijah Cummings is now he's put the entire Democratic Party in a position where they have to defend rats.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I agree. And, you know, you've got the Orkin list of the what most rat cities or whatever.
Rattiest
cities in America, if that's the correct term.
Rattiest cities in America, yeah.
You even had Elijah Cummings in 1999 criticizing his own community for being drug-infested. You have, you know, PBS, that legendary right-wing news site, you know, going and doing a story and a video just a year ago about the rat infestations in Baltimore. You had Joe Biden criticizing, Baltimore. I mean, all the Democrats have said the same thing. It's just when Trump says it, it's outrageous.
Yeah, I think the thing is, though, is from a Democrat perspective, you know, having these cities in the shape they're in, kind of makes their case for them. Not that, you know, they put it there, of course. They'll come up with some other reason. But we need more money. We need more money into, you know, pumping into these cities. If we just had more, homelessness wouldn't occur. If we had more, there would not be blighted zones in various places. Wouldn't have crime, this kind of thing. That's usually fits into their, you know, their mantra, right?
And yet you had one of the regional directors of HUD, an African-American woman, talk about the fact that in Baltimore last year, the Trump administration put $16 billion into Baltimore just last year. Barack Obama's, you know, shovel-ready projects put $1.6 billion into Baltimore, and it's worse than it ever was. So it is not a money issue. Mm-hmm. And as President Trump is now increasingly pointing out, where'd the money go? It's like Puerto Rico. It's like Haiti, these other places where there are these epic disasters. We send billions of dollars, and then you see pictures of pallets of bottled water still sitting out in the sun a year after the hurricane has passed, a year after the earthquake has ended. Where does the money go? And apparently some of it's going into Elijah Cummings and or his wife's pockets.
Yeah, but just those are little details, Steve. Of course, it's an allegation, but if you start looking into it, it's I saw a report. I'm not sure if this is true, Doug, but I saw a report that he has a net worth of multiple million dollars, Elijah Cummings.
That's the thing. Well, a lot of times we've asked questions over the years. Even Joe Biden's a rich guy now. And at one time, it was middle-class Joe. These guys get in there. They're in there for years and years. And they go in. Maybe they're just, you know, average income sort of people, small business people, whatever. And all of a sudden, they come out as millionaires. Right. I mean, many times we've asked that question over the years. How does that happen? And that's part of the swamp that, has been existing long before Donald Trump came around and probably will be there a long time after he leaves.
Doug, you bring up Joe Biden, and the main reason that he is the front runner, still, you know, polling about 30% with the rest of the pack trailing 15, 12, 9, 0, 1% in the polls. The reason he, you know, has emerged as the front runner and the likely nominee is because there's a sense that he's the only one that can actually beat President Trump. As he looks weak, as he looks discombobulated, as he can't even cite his own website on the stage, if he loses that veneer of inevitability and winnability, does he survive?
Yeah, that's the question. I think that's why you're hearing these whispers about Michelle Obama. right? I don't know if Michelle Obama wants to get in the race. I don't know if Michelle Obama has any interest. I don't know, want to take the abuse. But as Obama gets criticized in a Democrat debate,
I just love that.
Biden can't defend, right? If he can't defend the Obama-Biden sort of record, it's not seemed to me out of the realm of possibility that there would be a turn to, you know, Michelle Obama and say, look, you know, and Obama getting, you know, back involved and saying, look, we need to, you know, keep my legacy going, because if Donald Trump wins four more years, the legacy's gone. Yep. And if one of these progressives that are even, I guess, even more far left than Barack Obama was, then it's also gone.
So it's fourth and 10. And so you think the Democrats might go for a Hail Michelle pass.
But I think, Steve, that's a great call. Yeah, I do.
Steve, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's the Hail Michelle game plan. But, you know, she disclaimed it specifically, not just nuanced of, oh, I'm not sure that's right for me. You know, on Friday she did an interview that said, I'm not running. That's not what I want to do. That's not my skill set. I mean, again, you've seen politicians say, you know, if nominated, I won't accept. If elected, I won't serve. But she went about that far. And I think when you look at the fact that she, kind of like we were talking earlier today, Kamala Harris has very thin skin. She mm-hmm. would not like to be challenged. You know, she came off as this angry woman on the stage. Michelle Obama would be that on steroids if she had to be challenged, questioned about her background, questioned about her policy issues. She's never been through the ringer. She would not fare well in that. And I think you got to give her credit. She knows it.
That's right. Unlike Kamala Harris, who shows everyone that she doesn't know it.
The good news is there's no indication Michelle Obama ever dated Willie Brown.
But it would be a desperation move, right? I mean, but could you see, though, Elizabeth Warren's not going to beat Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders not going to beat Donald Trump, that there might be enough push, you know, to say, you know, I know you've said this publicly, but, you know, you owe it to the country. You got to – you owe it to your husband, Barack Obama, and, you know, and the legacy. And you there's no one else that can beat Donald Trump or get the enthusiasm or the African-American vote out for the Democrats.
You're going to run into a timeline issue, though, can you get on the ballot? Can you get the delegates? You know, would you throw out all these candidates who have actually earned delegates mm-hmm. and gone into the states and won votes – you know, with her saying, okay, suddenly she's going to show up at the convention and say, I want to be your nominee – technically, could they do it? Yes. But if you want to see the Bernie Sanders folks' heads really explode, steal the election from him a second time. You know, steal the election from all these folks who've actually gone out and run for president rather than stroll in and say, I want the job.
Of course, Bernie Sanders is doing a good job to have the nomination stolen from him. He's helping them steal it this time because he's so angry. And he's so miserable.
But that's how, you know, the whole Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders back and forth the first night of the debate this week, just, you know, neither one of them is likable. Ooh. And that's where, again, to me, the most scary candidate on the stage the two nights is Tulsi Gabbard. She's got a military background. She's articulate. She's not as whacked out as the rest of the crowd. She's beautiful. She would be a formidable candidate if she could get the traction and start to emerge. And first thing she has to do is make it into that September debate.
You know who has a similar view about Tulsi Gabbard? Steve Bannon. He's identified her as a very strong potential candidate. So
you could see a Biden Tulsi Gabbard candidacy?
That would make some sense.
The only problem is that because she's also opposed to coal and fossil fuels, if she's in Hawaii, she'll never make it back in time to run. Slow boat from Hawaii.
Good point.
That rowboat, that sailboat will never make it back in time. This is the Battleground State Report, battlegroundstatenews.com on the web, Battleground State News on Facebook. We're back in a moment. How about all the international stuff? China trade, North Korea lobbing missiles, Brexit. Is any of that going to play into this whole presidential and election year stuff or not? We'll talk about that in a moment as the Battleground State Report continues.
You're listening to the Battleground State Report.
A And welcome back in. This is the Battleground State Report. Steve Gill, Michael Patrick Leahy, Doug Kellett here with you. And one of the things that we're starting to see from the Democrats is attacks on Trump for supposedly failing to do the trade deals he said he would do. Now, first of all, he's done the trade deal, the NAFTA 2.0. I'm going to fix NAFTA. It was the worst deal in history, except for when we gave $1.8 billion in cash to the Iraqis or to the Iranians and promised to give them more. That was the worst deal ever. NAFTA was the second worst deal ever. And the president has negotiated a new deal with China, with Canada and Mexico. The Democrats are blocking it because they don't want NAFTA 2.0, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, to go into effect. That would create more jobs. Give a boost to the U.S. economy. They're literally holding American jobs hostage to promote the agenda of the Democrats, which is hurt the economy so we can say things are bad and win some races. And then you've got the China trade deal. You know, the president is battling China over them locking access to U.S. goods and products and services out of their market. And one of the problems, I think, with the president's team, again, as we talk about their communications process, we're hearing a lot about the president now saying, I'm going to raise taxes, tariffs on China goods, 10%. And yet they're not talking about the fact that China is already and has been imposing 10, 15, 25% taxes on U.S. goods, blocking out things like the cattle industry and steaks and burgers from China. They are charging higher tariffs, taxes on U.S. goods now. And the president's just responding. And yet it's being played as, oh, he's creating a trade war. He's fighting for either fair or free trade. And I don't think they're communicating that very well.
I agree entirely back to that issue of the team's communications. And again, part of it is I don't think anybody on the communication team really wants to bring something to the president that's not like right in his zone. Bring him something that's not exactly what he wants to do. But that's really what the job ought to be. But I don't see. I agree. It's a weakness, and it's a weakness that they need to fix right away. Because even though this crowd of 20, 24 Democratic candidates, they're all weak.
But you want that economy thriving, and perhaps, you know, if the U.S., and there are some indications that, you know, China had broken its word a month or so ago at the G20 that they were going to buy more soybeans. They haven't. Over the week, it appears that they may be buying, you know, several hundred thousand tons of soybeans. Will that stave off higher taxes, higher tariffs? Will that back things back a little bit, ratchet the tensions down? And then you've got all of what's going on in Hong Kong with the violence in the streets.
Yeah.
You've got Brexit and the chaos in the European Union and likely diminishing economic prosperity in Europe. How do these things affect the Joe Sixpack, Doug, you know, and our economy in a way that might have an impact on the presidential, Senate, and House races?
Yeah, I think it's hard to talk trade, Steve. Of course, you were kind of involved in it back in the 90s. I mean, I'm like you. I didn't like NAFTA and everything, and I would like to see something done. And, you know, and the Congress passed this new agreement. I think the problem, though, is that it's not a zero-sum game. It's never equitable. And the question is, who gets hurt the most, right? Is it China or the United States? I think there is a possibility that the American farmers could be, you know, they could be hurt more. You mentioned about cattle and the milk and dairy industry. In other words, I think it's a good idea in theory. I think we can all agree, we ought to do something about China. We ought to do something about, you know, getting them to knock off their tariffs and versus ours. But there's also something I think dangerous about just I'm going to put 10% on another 10% on $300 billion here or there. I think that's probably something maybe we might disagree on, because I think we need to be more careful maybe the way we're going about this.
But if they're charging us 10, 15, and 25% on our goods getting there, you know, President Trump's argument is, look, we've been in the fetal position in dealing with China, been afraid to say anything for 25 years and allowed them to literally stick it to us. And I think one of the things that, again, that appeals to voters about President Trump is he's fighting for America. His job is not to placate China. His job is not to placate the European Union or the Iranians or North Korea. His job is to fight for Americans, American jobs. And again, on Friday, 164,000 more jobs added in July, wages rising. He's winning for the American people. They've just got to make that case better.
And you know, you guys have pointed this out time and time again. It's really, you know, battleground states. It's about 50 individual states. And look at Iowa, right? I mean, Senator Joni Ernst may be in trouble as far as winning re-election. The farmer issue is huge there. They keep talking about, and Ernst does, about, you know, these tariffs are hurting, you know, her constituents. It only takes a few of these states to make a difference, though.
Well, here, the other problem, though, on China, let's say Biden is the nominee. Biden is, I mean, you could argue that there's a case of corruption by proxy. His son, with no experience whatsoever in managing a hedge fund, flies over there on Air Force Two with his dad, with his daddy. They get pictures taken. And then 2 weeks later, he's got $1.5 billion in a hedge fund he manages with John Kerry's stepson. That's exactly, you know, that's not exactly pursuing America's interests. The money in that hedge fund comes from the Bank of China, which is controlled by the Communist Party of China. He is compromised. Joe Biden is compromised on the China issue.
And the question is, what did they get for their money, and will we ever know? Now, Doug brought up a great point that we're not just focused, here at Battleground State Report on the presidential race, but these Senate races mm-hmm. will dictate who controls. During the debates this week, Republicans passed and approved in the Senate 13 more judges, confirmed 13 more federal judges. President Trump is literally putting in district court trial level judges, appellate court judges. He's put two Supreme Court judges in place. Keeping the Senate is critical. If you get President Trump reelected, keeping control of the Senate to be able to continue to confirm federal court judges, conservative judges, is critical. You've got some good news happening out there in Tennessee. President Trump has endorsed Bill Hagerty, who's the current ambassador to Japan, to come back and run for the U.S. Senate seat that's going to be vacated by Lamar Alexander. Doug Jones, the Democrat who won because of the chaos in Alabama, likely defeated, and
likely.
Republicans will pick a seat up there. I mean, there's talk that Joe Manchin may leave the Senate and go run for governor of West Virginia. As we've talked, you know, the coal issue has made West Virginia a red state. That could be a seat pickup. But you've got other seats that are a little bit more at risk, including Colorado, where you've got a tortured race that, Colorado is definitely a purple state.
And Cory Gardner is
tough win.
Yeah.
Can John James, an African-American superstar win in Michigan?
Hold it. According to Cory Booker, apparently the Russians are going to suppress his vote as well.
Because he is a black candidate. That would make it. How did they let, Senator Scott in South Carolina slip past the anti?
They weren't apparently playing in South Carolina. Okay.
Well, and then
Russians aren't big in South Carolina,
no.
I think, Steve.
Yeah.
Well, and then I don't know if you saw late this week, but Corey Lewandowski, one of the president's top guys, is thinking about running for the Senate in New Hampshire. While you've already got one Republican who looks pretty good to me on paper, General Baldick, who was one of the 12 strong. Remember that movie where they put the horse soldiers in Afghanistan? They made it into a movie. He was one of the 12 guys dropped into Afghanistan that went in right after 9/11. He's announced he's running for the U.S. Senate in New Hampshire against Gene Shaheen, a state that always swings about one point this way or that.
I like Corey, but I'm putting my money on the horseman general.
Why would Corey want to have a primary rather than having Republicans pick that seat up? I mean, again, maybe it's his ambition, but
I think there's some personal ambition there. But again, also, when you get at a certain level, you have a hard time really assessing what your strengths and weaknesses really are, right?
Yeah, I think you think you're the best one for any job, right? I mean, it's the same thing about running for president, where you've got a certain ego it takes to get to that level to run, right? So maybe that's what's going on.
Well, and
here,
presumably, Corey is making a lot of money, because of his connections, but apparently he's not. I mean, why would you take if you're making millions lobbying,
he's got to be making a lot of money lobbying, don't you think?
So why would you take a pay cut to about $184,000 a year to be a U.S. senator?
And have a good chance to lose, and then all the personal things that would come up, but we know well, it would be embarrassing. Possibly.
Hope Hicks will come in and campaign for him, presumably.
I'm not commenting on that.
I just switched from the Brigadier General to Corey and my vote there. I mean, you say that about why would he take a pay cut? Don't a lot of the politicians do that, Steve, really, in reality, whether they're business owners, lawyers, whatever their trade is?
If you're worth $50 million, it's worth it, right?
But if you're still earning it.
If you're still making your money, make your money. That, again.
Yeah, I mean, Corey's a former cop. He didn't make millions working on the Trump campaign. He's had to push clients aside because of the scandals post-Trump campaign and after he left the White House. again, if he's making money, again, why create a primary unless maybe he's looking for a gig with the Trump administration looking to get back in?
Who knows? It's one of those mysteries that will resolve itself over time. But I'm with you. Let the horse general let him run and give him the shot.
And you've got Kansas where you have Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, still being mentioned as a potential return to Kansas,
right,
run for the U.S. Senate because they're afraid Chris Kobach will lose that race the same way he lost the governor's race.
Largely because he's been undermined by the Republican establishment,
which is still in place in Kansas.
That's a very good point.
So you've got a lot of these. I mean, you've got.
I think Kobach is a fantastic guy. I mean, I think he's right on all the issues. But you're right. There is a weakness because of the establishment Republican opposition to him in Kansas. Yeah.
And then you've got Arizona where, you know, we're fighting to keep a Senate seat that was appointed after Kyrsten Sinema won the contest. Kyrsten Sinema, by the way, coming out tough on the border and tough on illegal immigration. Maybe she's reading the polls.
Well, and McSally, you know, she voted for the big budget deal. That's a big blowout deal. And she's really an awful candidate. I see her very vulnerable in 2020. She couldn't win in 2018. She got appointed. Why was she appointed? It's all bad news, really, in Arizona for the Senate race.
I mean, the map is not good for Republicans. And where do you pick up seats if you lose one here or lose one there? And I think, again, we're going to focus a lot on the presidential race at Battleground State News, battlegroundstatenews.com, Battleground State News on Facebook. But we're not paying attention to the Senate races, because keeping control of the Senate is critical if President Trump gets reelected to be able to do something.
The best chances for pickups are Alabama, for sure, and Michigan. Michigan's a good opportunity, but Colorado's in jeopardy. Arizona's big time in jeopardy.
Susan Collins in Maine, I think, survives just because she does reflect her state well.
She does. She does. It'll be 52-48. Yeah, she'll win. That
New Hampshire would be an important one to pick up. So, again, a bitter primary doesn't serve us well.
Does not
Tom
help.
Tillis in North Carolina is being challenged,
could
very vulnerable in a primary, which would make whoever wins vulnerable in
yeah.
a general.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll see.
We'll talk more about the Senate map in the weeks ahead. And next week, maybe we'll talk a little bit about the U.S. House. Is there a shot for Republicans to pick up the House, to take the gavel back from Nancy Pelosi? Certainly Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and AOC are doing everything they can to help Republicans retake the House, and we'll talk about that next week. In the meantime, go to battlegroundstatenews.com, Battleground State News on Facebook. You have a great weekend. We'll be back next weekend.